Tonight on Best of the Festivals, it's modern manners and a story about memories and the interweaving of the past and present. We'll learn about the work and life of writer Mandy Sayer, whose latest book, The Poet's Wife, completes the first trilogy of literary memoir ever published in Australia. The first volume, Dreamtime Alice, recounts the years she spent as a busker in America, tap dancing with her jazz drummer father. Her second memoir, Velocity, charts the author's turbulent childhood and adolescence. The Poet's Wife follows up with a heartbreaking account of her marriage to African-American poet Yusuf Kominyaka and Mandy Sayer's beginnings as a serious writer. The presenter of RN Books Plus, Kate Evans, spoke with Mandy Sayer at this year's Sydney Writers' Festival.
I think I need to start with the really hard part of interviewing you or having a conversation with you and doing your work justice. Because you write memoir and because you lay yourself bare, it's tempting just to ask you for stories about your life. But if I do that, is that ignoring your skill as a writer?
Probably, yes. I always say simply is that non-fiction is what happened and fiction is what could have happened, and there are big differences. However, a lot of my fiction does come out of real experience, but I certainly, as a novelist and fiction writer, like to twist reality and craft it into something new that non-fiction cannot do.
Can you remember when you first began to do that? Because in part of your memoirs you do talk about your emergence as a writer, but making sense of your life by telling stories, is that something that you were aware of as a child, for example?
Yes, I think so. I just, even rather than writing stories, I just loved writing. I just liked writing the alphabet. I remember the day I learned to draw the W, and I just draw W over and over again. So it was something about that tactility that I loved, apart from telling stories. And the first writing that I did do was actually poetry, and I wrote that for many years as a child, very bad poetry, mind you. But I guess because I come from a musical family, I was interested in how much language could integrate music and rhythm. And so, curiously, now that I've gone through many genres, I'm returning to poetry now because I really love playing with language that does not necessarily have to be narrative. That's something much closer to music.
And when you say your family was musical, and it's the rhythm of it that's dominated the music, hasn't it? I mean, your father was a drummer.
Yes, and I was a tap dancer. So when I was a kid, he used to play drums on my head, so he was literally beating the rhythms into my head while he was playing along with the music. So, yeah, I did get it beaten into me.
The tone of your memoirs is something that really struck me, and I remember reading Dreamtime Alice when it was first published in, I think, about 1999. Yeah. And there's such an exuberance in the way that you write about your life at the same time as you're often writing about really tough stuff. Mm-hmm. So you're not writing into a sort of misery memoir genre. What do you think you are doing? Is it about finding the joy in life, or is that energy about something else?
I really love to find the beauty in ugliness. All my fiction can be read like that as well. I love to see working class and the underclass coming out with the most beautifully articulate points of view and sayings. So I'm always trying to find beneath all that mud is the lotus flower growing out of it. That's very, very important to me. And because I come from a working class background, and I still very much live in a working class community, I love to see that integrated. I'm not really interested in paradise. Writing about paradise would not interest me at all. I'd love to find the beauty in the ugliness.
In looking straight at that ugliness, though, is it like pressing on bruises?
Yes, but it's an enjoyable process. It's kind of like scratching an itch, in a way. It's painful, but it's also enjoyable because there's something at stake, I guess. If I didn't feel like it was a challenging process writing any of these books, I probably wouldn't try it. I'm interested in that complexity.
Did you have projects in terms of what it was you wanted to do with each of your volumes of memoirs? And in reading Velocity, for example, I was struck by how much it was about your mother, mm-hmm. where Dreamtime Alice was perhaps more about your father, and then the latest novel explores your relationship with your then husband.
Yeah.
Do you see these memoirs as about slices of time or about exploring each of those relationships?
Well, none of that is conscious, and I never set out to even write a memoir when I wrote my first one. It was just my first husband encouraging me, saying, look, these are fabulous experiences, you must get them down and publish them as a memoir, which I did eventually, but I never had an idea about writing a second one till the second husband came along and said, your childhood's extraordinary, you must write these down or else I'm going to steal the stories and put them in my own work, which he would have done. He's stolen enough already, but that's okay. There's plenty of material from my family to go around. So it was with that challenge I wrote Velocity, and it was after my father had died, and it was the right time to do it, and it just came out like a train. It's probably been inside me all my life, but I wrote it in 6 months, and it's basically a first draft, so I don't know how that happened. Again, these things are not conscious. It took me 11 years to write Dreamtime Alice and 6 months to write Velocity. Why? I don't know. I really don't know. And I never had any designs to write a third memoir either. I don't have a plan or anything like that because I switch between non-fiction and fiction. I always find that the book I'm writing now is always an antidote to the one I've published before. So I need some kind of change, whether it's generic change or material. So I like to go back and forth.
Well, given that, am I right in thinking that Dreamtime Alice was the first in the memoirs that you wrote?
Yes. Yeah.
So explain for people who perhaps haven't read it what it was that you were focusing on in that story. It was your tap dancing life.
Oh, I think essentially it took me a long time to figure out what the book was about and what I was actually writing about, because I did not have much experience as a professional writer. It took me a long time to develop the voice, but I figured it out. I was trying to be a part of my father's life, a part of my story, father's stories and his mythology. See, I grew up with a father who was a great storyteller, being a jazz drummer, and all his stories were larger than life, tall stories about his past. And growing up, I was never a part of these stories, and I wanted to be a character. I wanted to be mythologised in his stories as well. So that the part of the reason why I think I went to New York to tap dance and perform on the streets with him was to, the only way to have a relationship with him was to perform with him. And so I was trying to work my way into his life and obviously gain his approval and love in the process. It's a very challenging and hard one way to do it, but I did.
Because he was somebody who kept on leaving and then returning all through your childhood.
That's right. And also I think because he was such a great storyteller, the fact that he was illiterate really weighed on me as a child, because I picked up writing very quickly and reading very quickly. And because he could not write anything more than his own name, I felt a sense of responsibility to record his stories, because if I didn't, they would be lost forever. Part of it was the fact that he didn't have the ability and I did.
And so how old were you when you headed off to New York to join your dad?
I was 20 and he was 63. And at a time when most people are putting their feet up and retiring, he jumped on a plane with me and went to New York to perform with me on the streets. I hope I had that amount of spirit when I reached that age.
The work that you did on the streets is something that is also a very dynamic part of The Poet's Wife as well. Can you just describe how it worked, what you did? It sounded like all you needed was a pair of tap shoes and a piece of plywood.
Yeah, and a bit of talent. what we would do, we'd have recorded music, usually big band music, like Glenn Miller and Woody Herman. And he was a big band drummer at the Trocadero, so he was playing the same music as he had when he was a child, really. So he had a full kit of drums here in Sydney. When we were in the States, it was just a snare drum and woodblock. And so he would play along and I would tap dance dressed as a clown in fishnet stockings. We'd do a show for about 15 minutes and I'd have the hat out there. But then by working in America over the years, I learnt a lot of techniques about how to street perform correctly. And actually a little black kid in New Orleans taught me how to hustle, because I wasn't making any money. He was only about 6 or 7 and he sat back. He was a tap dancer also. He said, man, you ain't going to make any money like that. You got to get out there and get it. He said, grab that hat as soon as the chunks finish, you get out there and you get it. And so he trained me to get out there and get it. And even though it was illegal, that was the only way we could survive in New Orleans.
And making the right pitch, finding the right spot was really important as a performer too, wasn't it?
Oh, yes, being a tap dancer, I, at first I had a portable plywood board that we folded up and took onto public transport in New York City. Imagine that, getting on a bus. They always tried to kick us off the bus, but my dad would get the money into the tray just before he kicked us off, so he couldn't. And then we'd bring in all the instruments and the hardwood board and everything onto the bus. Yeah.
It might sound, though, as if by travelling America with your dad that you had this sort of protective figure with you.
Yeah, far from it.
You didn't.
No, he was more like a kind of rat bag younger brother. He was completely naive. He would trust everybody. He'd get into all sorts of trouble. You know, you think, was it Mick Dundee was naive in New York? What do you read about my dad? You know, that's not a drum, this is a drum, you know. So he got us into quite a lot of strife, and I tried to get us out of a lot of strife, and then we get into more strife together.
Well, can you describe for us where you were living in New Orleans, sorry, as you begin the Poet's Wife? So it sounds like you were in an extraordinary set of, I mean, not quite squats, I think you had to pay,
but it was pretty marginal. There were rooms behind a witchcraft shop. They were very, very tiny, but we could only afford what was called a closet, the closet, and it was about the size of that plywood, but it had a shelf, and so my dad could lie on the floor, his head touching one floor wall and his feet touching the other wall, and our drums would be just there, and there was a shelf, and I slept on the shelf, and the only other shelving was there was a window with no glass, but you could open it up and look over the roofs, and there were shelves in there. But we'd put our few possessions on those shelves, and inevitably I'd knock them out because there was no glass in the window. So we were living there when I met my husband-to-be, and that's the start of The Poet's Wife.
So you met this man. What was your sense of him when you first met him?
Well, I met him under unusual circumstances. It was Mardi Gras Day, 1985. And my father and I had worked on Bourbon Street for about 9 hours straight, because Mardi Gras Day is the day the street performers earn the most money. So we worked very, very hard in order to get through Mardi Gras and pay our rent. And so after that, I was exhausted, and I arranged to go to a nightclub to a wedding reception, a Brazilian wedding reception. So that's where I met Youssef. I was still dressed in my top hat and tails. It was a fancy dress party, and so everyone was dressed up and dancing to a Latin American band, and that's where I first met him. We struck up a conversation about Patrick White in the bar, and the rest is history. I'll never forgive Patrick White for that.
Well, the rest is a very, very complicated history, and you're laying yourself bare for us in all of these novels, but I wondered, as you went through this story of your life with Youssef, mm-hmm. whether you also had lawyers hovering over your shoulder.
Because No, not at all, no. I've been through, you know, having written two former memoirs, I've learned how to do it now, and I always write a first draft as if it's no one's ever going to read it, and it's never going to be published. I don't compromise on anything in a first draft. I use all the right names, all the right places are correct, and because I always know that once it's submitted for publication and a legal department gets a hold of it, then it starts to be reduced and compromised. So with a first draft, that's my version, and that will always exist. Even if it ends up in a library, there is my version, and yet the published one will be somewhat compromised. So, no, I don't have a problem with that at all. I was terrified of my ex-husband's reaction, of course, but that's the thing with memoir writing. I guess you have to feel the fear and do it anyway.
And I leapt in a bit early with that question, really, because so far all you've described is meeting this charming man.
Yeah.
And he was a charming man at first. He was clever, but he was also many different people, wasn't he?
Very, very complex, yeah. And I think part of the reason why I wrote the memoirs to understand him and to understand what happened to us, because, all marriages has its ups and downs, but these were manic highs and lows, and I was trying to understand retrospectively what had happened to me, because I actually lost my mind during the marriage.
Well, he had a range of different voices. He almost literally had different voices and ways of speaking.
Yeah.
Can you explain that for us?
Sure. Well, it came up because he did an interview at Sydney University. He was hoping to get a teaching position. And when we went in, I went with him. Suddenly he went from sounding like B.B. King to Laurence Olivier, like that. I was like, where did that come from? And when we got home, I asked him, what was that all about? And he said, it's called switching codes. And he explained that if you're a black person growing up in the South and you don't know how to switch codes, you're not going to live long. And so it goes back to slavery, whereby, you know, the slave owners would, you know, obviously be trying to control them, and so the slaves would communicate in their own codes so that the master wouldn't understand what they were talking about. To an extent, we all switch codes, but someone who is a minority, and probably happens in a lot of minority cultures, is that you have to be much more aware and much more extreme in your switching to fit in.
But this switching and the way that he did that, not just in his language, but in the way that he presented himself to the world and how he interacted with people, was this also something that fed into his skill as a poet? Because you do give us glimpses into his work, and it really is extraordinarily powerful poetry.
Mm. I'd never thought about that. It's quite possible. That's a good point, Kate. I'm not sure. I know that someone else brought this up in Adelaide, something quite similar, is that because he could be so, have so many faces in public and in private, that, yeah, probably that did assist him in assuming different voices in his poetry. Possible, yeah.
I'd like to ask about the relationship of your writing to each other, because it seems that he trusted you with his work fairly on in the relationship. He asked you to read it and give you feedback. How important was that to you?
Well, it was tremendously flattering and a lot of fun. I loved editing his poetry. It was like a wonderful jigsaw puzzle or game that we could play together. And also he gave me feedback on my work as well. So as a creative couple, it was an incredibly strong relationship. However, emotionally and in terms of intimacy, very barren. And so it was it's an odd combination where you've got these two incredible minds that are almost working as one and yet can't discuss their sex life with one another.
Well, and also with him you moved away from New Orleans, you moved into different sort of cultures, some of which isolated you tremendously.
Yeah.
What impact did that have on your writing?
I find that I don't work well away from home. I'm not one of these coffee shop people or anything like that. I have to be home in my bed with my laptop and with my two little dogs. So, yeah, moving around did mess with me, but also because it affected my depression really badly. I mean, I was suffering from depression and had not been diagnosed. So when we moved to places where I was even more isolated, of course, I start going even more loopy, and that did affect my writing very much. That's probably the only time I've ever had writer's block. It wasn't that I was intellectually incapable, it was that my brain wasn't functioning properly because I was so depressed.
But it's also in this period that it seems that the relationship was getting crueler and crueler, and that you're showing us more and more of an abusive relationship. And part of the conflict seemed to be that he was threatened by your writing.
When we met, the differences were so stark, you know. I was 22, he was 44. He was a published poet. At the time we met, I didn't even know what a metaphor was. And in a very fast amount of time, I caught up to a certain extent, and I think he was a bit shocked by that and probably didn't want to lose me, you know, because I think part of the reason why the relationship worked for him was that he had someone he could dominate, and that was part of the dynamic, that he was the elder passing on the information, which was great, but the apprentice got a little out of control too quickly for him. Yeah,
but he was encouraging you though, yeah, to write your memoir, Dreamtime Alice.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing about that is that Dreamtime Alice could almost be read as a road movie and a buddy movie with you and your dad.
Yeah.
But your dad and Yusuf didn't get on, did they?
Oh no. They were like chalk and cheese. They hated one another, loathed one another. So that was difficult. I felt like the meat in the sandwich all the time. And yet I loved and respected both of them. But my father considered Yusuf a threat because Yusuf's university educated and, you know, intellectual. And most of the black men that my father loved and admired were, you know, musicians, of course. And Yusuf didn't play an instrument, so that was hard for him to figure out. And my dad was horrible to Yusuf. You know, when we were up, just after we were married, my dad would say at the dinner table, OK, Mandy, when are we going back out on the road? He'd say that in front of Yusuf, and he'd deliberately piss him off and tease him. Yeah.
But the other point of conflict was whether you'd not just go out on the road, but whether and when you'd come back to Australia.
Yeah.
How did place figure in your relationship? Australia.
Oh, it was a great source of conflict, actually, probably the biggest source of conflict, because part of my depression, I think, was the fact that I was isolated from friends and family, and I'm very, very close to my family, even though they drive me crazy.
Read velocity.
Yeah. And my parents were still alive, and I was terrified that they would pass away while I was in America, and I wanted to spend time with them. And he didn't like being here because he thought it was racist and yada, 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 I don't know. So that was always a point of conflict for us. Because whenever I was here, I didn't have depression and I wrote well. So I don't think it was a coincidence.
And overwhelmingly, when you were back here in Australia, you were in King's Cross. And I'd like to ask you about the role of King's Cross in both your life and your writing.
Yeah.
Because in Velocity, in your childhood memoir, I'm struck by how much the diversity and the dynamism of the Cross was a safe place for you,
yeah,
particularly as a schoolgirl, yeah, having to deal with, you know, the nastiness,
yeah,
of the schoolyard.
Yeah.
What does the Cross mean to you?
Oh, well, I think it's nostalgia, obviously. It was the last place that my family lived as a one unit before we split up and were never in the same room ever again in our whole lives.
Can you describe what that was like, though, when you were there as one unit?
Well, as I said, you know, I love finding the beauty in the ugliness. And, well, there was five of us living in two rooms in a basement on Victoria Street, King's Cross, just before the Green Bands came in and the redevelopment. And we used to sleep on the floor. You know, it was extremely basic. My mother used to cook on a gas stove in the hallway, and it was very run down and dank. But we were happy. It was the best summer of my life, that summer. And
how old were you?
9. And that's where I started writing seriously, she says pretentiously. My parents were asleep one afternoon, and I stole some money out of my father's trousers, walked across the road to the milk bar, bought an exercise book, came back and sat down while they were sleeping, and I wrote my first short story. When they woke up, my mother read it and wanted me to read it aloud, and she invited everyone. That the house was full of unemployed musicians and actors and lots of eccentrics. Mick Fowler was there, and she invited everyone down, and I was too shy, so she read the story to everyone. And so I guess King's Cross was my first muse, and has remained one, simply because it really jolted my imagination in a way the suburbs never had before. I knew that this place was different and intriguing, and everyone seemed to get along well with one another. It was extraordinary. It was flower children everywhere, and it was safe. It was, the Vietnam War was on, and I remember my dad sending me up at 10 o'clock at night in my dressing gown and slippers to the village to buy him a hamburger for dinner, and I'd walk up through the back lanes in my pajamas, and everything was fine. It's great.
Well, and so it was also a refuge when you came back to Australia with Yusuf.
Yeah.
But you also, you were working really hard. I mean, you were the economic provider for a lot of that relationship, weren't you?
Yeah, in the beginning, yes. Yes, I was. I was tap dancing up on the corner of Roslyn and Darlinghurst Road, and Yusuf used to be kind of like my bodyguard. So I'd be tap dancing away, and he'd hate it when people used to come up to him and say, "Bet you taught her everything she knows." And he's so pissed off, you know, with the stereotyping. But the Aborigines loved him up there, and he got along very well with them and wrote some lovely poetry about some of the Indigenous culture and some of the Indigenous people he met.
Well, some of his award-winning poetry is set in Sydney, isn't it?
Yep, that's right.
And when we say award-winning, I mean, it's part of it seemed that he wanted a certain type of recognition.
Yes.
And he ended up with a Pulitzer Prize for poetry.
Yes.
So we're talking very serious recognition.
Yes.
How important was that to him?
Oh, it was very important. Really, really important. I mean, the year before, he kind of half-teasingly complained that, well, when am I going to win the Pulitzer Prize type thing? And I thought he was sort of having himself on, but there you go, the following year he won it. It was hard for him because he wondered whether it was because he was black, you know, that weighed upon him a bit, like how well it had been received. And then he worried that people would publish anything he wrote once he'd won the Pulitzer. So he did take stock, but really he couldn't handle it, and his life completely unravelled. He was probably a better poet in his struggle and in opposition to the status quo than being accepted. And that's why I think I'm quite happy not to have that amount of success, because I like pushing against things. I don't like being a part of them.
Which seems to be part of the appeal of the cross as well.
Exactly.
That it's a place where you can do that.
That's right.
And he was a Vietnam veteran as well, and that, again, he wrote about that in some of his very successful poetry. Now, what was he like as a performer? Was he a very dynamic performer of his own work?
Well, the great thing for him was that because he's an incredibly shy person, I mean, he'd have a hard time looking you in the eye, just having a cup of coffee with him. Very, very shy in public. So when he began performing his work, it was like he's got this incredible voice, this incredible reading voice. I don't know if you've heard him on YouTube or anything, but, you know, so much so that, you know, women would be throwing their underpants up on the stage while he was reading, you know. No, truly. And, it was like a rock star or something. And so and he's treated like a rock star. So he found this wonderful life as a performer as well. And I think it helped his self-confidence a lot.
But one of the reasons I asked you that was, in fact, the knickers being thrown at him aspect of it.
Yeah.
Because women were throwing themselves at him.
Yeah, and the sad thing is, I could see retrospectively that, and knowing his background, is that when he was growing up, if you went out with a white woman, you could be shot, okay? So at this point of his life, he's got white women throwing themselves at him. It's going to be really hard to resist that. And actually, I never thought it was about sex. It was about power and about feeling wanted and popular.
You do describe, though, some really confronting scenes when you two are out and you do experience racism, though.
Yeah.
There was one where you were performing, I think, and suddenly realised that the audience had just disappeared because you were there with him.
Yes, that's right. And that's why even though he complained about Australia being racist, it was never as bad as that, never. It was the night before I was going to get married to Yusuf, and he came to the gig at the Elks Club. My dad was playing, and the room was probably as full as this, watching us perform. And within half an hour, all but one person had left, and that was because a black man was in the room. And during the interval, the manager came up and said, "Well, look, you can stay and your dad can stay, but your friend's got to go." And I said, "Oh, really?" I said, "By the way, he's not my friend, he's my fiancé, and tomorrow we're getting married." And walked out, and I was never allowed back. My dad was allowed to play there, but I wasn't. And I thought, well, if I can't stand up for him now, I shouldn't be marrying him, you know, if I can't put up with this. And it didn't bother me as much as it bothered him, naturally, because I hadn't grown up with that kind of prejudice. But, you know, it just hit his buttons. Naturally, if you're dealing with people like that every day, of course you'd go...
What impact, though, did his infidelity have on you? Because it seemed that you didn't even know about it for a while, and then as the relationship is falling apart...
One of the reasons why I started to lose my mind is because, you know, women, you have a feeling, you know when something's wrong, and yet they're telling you nothing's wrong, and you don't actually have any direct evidence, OK? So when your gut's saying, no, there's something wrong, but your head's saying, look, where is the evidence? And part of me didn't want to know, of course. By the time I found out that he deliberately started a family without telling me, well, that was all the evidence I needed, really, to leave. Anyway,
it took a long time, though.
But I also felt so stupid that, you know, it had been going on for years and I'd been telling myself that I was the one with the problem, you know. And if I was just a better housewife or a better lover or a better writer or a better academic, that things would be better. So I really put myself through the ringer over that. I'm kind of irritated at my own naivete.
Just to return to the decisions that you made as a writer, as you're laying yourself bare for us in these memoirs, but as I say, with this extraordinary exuberance at the same time, I came to really notice how you named and described people, because there's so many characters who walk in and out of this complicated life on the streets and in your relationship and so on, and many of them just have a first name. Mm-hmm. But the people who've treated you badly, mm-hmm, get the full name
really?
Treatment.
Very good. Excellent. I'd never... You're a very good critic.
Well, but I was really interested in the choices you were making in doing that. So, for example, you mentioned earlier that Yusuf had been interviewed for a job at Sydney University.
Yeah.
One of the people who interviewed
Dame
him...
Dame Leonie Kramer!
Mind you, if you just called her Leonie, many people would have known who you meant. But she was...
You couldn't make an upper name like that, could you?
But she was certainly sort of named and shamed for her high-handedness.
Yes.
There was a doctor who... consistently misdiagnosed an ectopic pregnancy.
Yeah, I had to change that name, though.
Oh, did you?
Oh, yeah, because I might have been sued. So, but he gets a full name too. These are all unconscious decisions on my part. That's fascinating.
But given that you're telling your story and your experiences, but you are telling the story of friends and families and other people around you,
yeah.
How hard is that as a writer? What sort of decisions or, you know, ethical things do you need to go through in deciding how you approach your memoir writing?
Yeah, I had those problems mostly with Dreamtime Alice, and through writing that I worked them out. And what it is that I can honestly say, I always write from a position of not having any axe to grind or with any sense of revenge. And if I'm starting to feel that, I back off, because I'm not being objective. So I found that if I am objective enough and write it with a heart, with a bigger enough heart, that you're not trying to get back at someone, you're trying to understand their behaviour, that tends to work. And I think readers can smell when you're grinding an axe. They can smell it when you're being disingenuous or you're blowing your own trumpet. And so I'm really conscious of that. And also, I don't go easy on myself either. That's part the art of it too, is that, you know, usually I'm just as brutally honest about myself as I am with anyone else. I try and balance it as much as possible, and you know, write it with a big open heart.
But even, I mean, there are all sorts of positive and joyous stories that some people may want to keep private rather than share.
Sure.
So what did your family make of, well, things, for example, the details in Velocity of, you know, violence and, you know, really tough stuff in your childhood. What did your family make of that?
Well, fortunately, my mother died 6 weeks before it was published, so she never had to read it. Truly. That was the only thing that disturbed me, was that she would read it and be upset by it. So my parents never had to read it. everyone else in the family was fine. My family, they don't read a lot at all. In fact, I post my articles on Facebook and they don't even bother reading them, you know. They could actually be in the article and they won't read it, which is great, because then I never get any flack, see. So it's quite good having disinterested relatives.
I mean, you said some of the difficulties were with Dreamtime Alice. So did some of that come back at you? I mean, did you have problems with...
Yeah. My dad spat the dummy and didn't talk to me for about a month and then came back and apologised and cried and wept, and it actually made our relationship so much better, you know. I should have written it years before. My mother did not respond. She didn't say if she'd read it or not, but I found out at her funeral that she had read it, and she turned up to her best friend's place, knocked on the door and walked in. She said, "I've read the book. I'm very upset. It's all true."
Which is probably the best possible response in some ways, isn't it?
Yeah, it was. So, I've been pretty lucky. But with The Poet's Wife, my sister read it, and she rang me up and left a message. She said, "This book is amazing. You've got to ring me back right away." I went, she's never reacted like that about anything I've written before. You know, so I ring her back and I said, "Yeah, what did you like about it?" She said, "Oh, this is amazing, you know." And then she just talked about her own marriage. And she said, "It's just like my marriage." And they just recently split up after 10 years. And she said, "You know, I was thinking about taking him back, but after reading your book, there's no bloody way." So I'm glad she felt empowered by it.
Before we go to some questions from the floor, if anybody has them, I just wondered about Yusuf's impact on your writing or not, because, I mean, it's a story of this, what ends up being this terribly destructive relationship. But I read some advice recently that you were giving to emerging writers about printing out their work and editing it line by line, which is a process that you describe as something that you and Yusuf did with each other's work. Yes. Has he been a useful influence in terms of your writing?
Oh, my writing practice, absolutely. I doubt I'd be the writer I am without having had the relationship. An enormous impact upon me. He sent me to university. He encouraged my, you know, my education, my writing. He picked up my terrible spelling early on and believed in me in a way my parents never had, or nobody else had ever believed in me. And I think that's another reason why I stuck it out for so long.
There's a question down the front and there's one just here as well.
Jill McCann.
I would like to take this opportunity to say thank you for The Poet's Wife. It is a blast, and everybody's got to buy it and read it. It is absolutely wonderful. And it may not rhyme, but it sings, Mandy.
Thank you. I'll pay you off
and
outside.
The other thing I wanted to say was you said you were going to go back to poetry, to write. Have you considered writing songs? After all, you had rhythm beaten into your head. Your music must be in your DNA. Please write some songs.
I have written songs. Yeah.
Good. Well, we want somebody really great to sing them for you.
Great.
And thank you.
Thank you.
I loved your book, Mandy. It was terrific. But I did wonder, have you had any communications with Yusuf about the book?
Yeah, look, it was a big risk, but I was counting on the fact that he is now 73 years old and probably wouldn't want to go through a long litigation. The second thing was is that I have all the documentation to back up my claims, and he does not realise this. I have copies of his original birth certificate. I've got his military records. He doesn't know I've got any of this stuff. I pinched it before I left him. So I was pretty confident that I could defend myself in court if it came to that. I was worried about him emotionally, definitely. But I thought, well, I'm not going to ring him up and tell him, because he's just going to bawl me out and tell me not to do it and make me feel guilty. So the only way he found out was through a journalist who was doing a story for The Good Weekend. And she told me beforehand she was going to contact him. And I said, look, if you ask him these questions, he won't cooperate and he'll just ring me up and hassle me. And, of course, that's exactly what happened. He found it difficult to cooperate with a journalist because she was controlling the narrative and not he. And so what he'd do all over Christmas and New Year, he'd ring up every half an hour and hang up and not leave a message, trying to catch me off guard. Because, you know, any sensible person would leave a message and I'd ring back, but then I could record the message and he wouldn't want any record of it. So I just screened my calls and drove him crazy. And he's stopped now.
Well, perhaps then I will slip in another one. The memoir project, will it continue or are you going to focus on fiction and poetry?
Oh, what I'm more interested in doing at this point is I'm interested in writing non-fiction, but not about myself. So I'm working on a couple of non-fiction books. Because I've been getting into long-form journalism, I'm finding that a really rewarding form, because it takes me back to my short story writing, really, and I look at them like non-fiction short stories. They're about 3,000, 4,000 words long, but that's whatever I'm interested in at that time. Like, I've just finished a story on pensioners who deal drugs to top up their pensions. Now, that was fascinating. I did another one on child gangs because I was just fascinated with that subject. So I'm definitely pursuing that, and I'm doing some poetry and halfway through a novel as well. So there's lots of little balls in the air.
Thank you.
Mandy Sayer with Kate Evans. Her latest book, the third in her memoirs series, is called The Poet's Wife. Cassie McCullough with you for Best of the Festivals, a month-long event at 6 every night here on RN. We're bringing you the very best sessions from writers' festivals held around the country over the past year. And you can find all the details and listen at your leisure and stock up for those long car rides at Best of the Festivals via the RN homepage. One of the most popular festival guests of the year was writer and BBC broadcaster Sandy Toksvig. Her sessions on modern manners at the Sydney Writers' Festivals had audiences in stitches. Sandy Toksvig's latest book is Mind Your P's and Q's. She's in conversation with Lucinda Holdforth, the author of Manners Matter, the case for chivalrous behaviour in a barbarous world. Let's hear a part of their conversation about etiquette.
It's one of the oldest topics for writing. There are papyruses in the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris, which are more than 5,000 years old, from the Egyptian 5th dynasty, and they're about manners. And actually, it's the same stuff that we talk about now, about truthfulness and self-control and how the younger generation is going to hell in a handcart. Things haven't changed, so I was very interested in why we want to know about manners, and then also looking at, of course, they have evolved.
And there's also the fact about manners being seen as highfalutin etiquette, when in fact it comes down to very simple and sane rules about how we get along. So one of the books that I loved was Erasmus's Guide for Boys, written in 1530, and he has very, very handy things about if you feel the need to fart, best not to hold it in for health reasons, so just utter a little cough to cover it. Remarks about belching, a whole range of things, but these were also about hygiene and health. And one thing, I don't know if it drives you crazy, Sandy, but of course one of the injunctions was against spitting.
Yeah.
So here in Australia, as I watch the football or the cricket, all I can see is men spitting. And there's so much talk about them being role models. Meanwhile, in China, there's a huge national campaign to stop people spitting. Yeah. And here in Australia, I think, are we actually regressing back to barbarism?
I'm not interested in sport, so I've never seen this, but spitting, just to come back to that, one of the reasons we have lots of rules about table manners is that we don't like each other's moistness. That's the thing, we just don't care for it.
I agree entirely.
So you don't want to see somebody's food rolling around in their mouth. That's why eat with your mouth closed. There are lots of reasons about it, and we are funny about it.
Sandy, you're a very public figure, and especially in England. I want to ask you, how do you find the manners of the general public when you're out and about?
People are so delightful. I've been on television since I was 23. I first started in 1982. So when I started on television in the UK, there was only 3 channels. So you can't imagine how many channels. How many channels you have here? You must have the same as
us. Way too many.
Too many.
Nothing on them.
And still nothing you want to watch,
nothing,
right?
Nothing, whatever.
So we had BBC One, which was a sort of family channel. We had BBC Two, which was for anybody who'd read a book. And then we had ITV, which is sort of cheap and tawdry. And I was on ITV. So when there were only three channels, you became famous very, very quickly because there was a limited amount of stuff. So as a consequence, lots of people in the public feel they know me, which is lovely, and lots of people come up and chat to me. I never cease to be amazed what people think it's appropriate to talk to me about. Shall I tell them a quick story about the woman
Shall I tell them? I think you must.
So, I'm taking my daughter to an open day at Bournemouth University. Well, she's 32, it's time. And do they never leave home now? Is that it? They just don't go.
They don't go.
So Bournemouth is on the coast, south coast, beautiful place. And we're driving down. We stopped at one of those motorway service stations. Now, I freely admit this is politically incorrect of me, but I dislike motorway service stations, okay? They may be delightful in Australia. In the UK, the minute you enter them, I don't know what it is, you start swimming in a fantastically shallow gene pool. And seriously, do you not feel it's full of people who've gone there for that outing? They're just full of people going, let's go to the services for the day. Oh, good idea. So we go in, and my daughter does what children are now, I think, trained to do. She goes straight off to a retail opportunity, presuming that I'm following with money. Anyway, I haven't got any money, so I go over to this cash machine. And I can't see well without my glasses on, right? So I'm concentrated. I'd left the glasses in the car. And this little old lady barreled up to me. Okay, she was wearing something in England we call a pack-a-mac. It's a little crinkly Macintosh that you can fold up in your handbag. It makes the most fantastic early warning sound. I don't know where she was going. Maybe she was being made to go to see the sea one last time on a coach trip. I don't know. But so she comes, I'm concentrating on the cash machine. She comes up to me and she goes, hello, Sandy. I said, oh, hello, hi, and I'm carrying on like this. She said, you're very funny. I said, that's very kind. Thank you so much. I carry on like this. She said, but that's not why I like you. I said, no. She said, no, Sandy, I like you because you like me and not a specific shape. And then she buggered off to die. I don't know what happened to her, but...
Yes. Now, Sandy, I want to ask you, when I was writing about manners, I was very conscious that people were going to accuse me of kind of celebrating oppression, conformism, sort of class consciousness and so on. But I think you may be my model for the well-mannered rebel, and if I'm not mistaken, you may or may not have departed swiftly from a number of schools. Is that not correct? And did you do it politely?
So I went to school in New York. Most of my upbringing was in New York, and I remember this particular teacher said, well, class, this year we're going to do Catcher in the Rye. It's a seminal work by J.D. Salinger. Here are your copies of Catcher in the Rye. So I went home, and I read Catcher in the Rye, and I came in the next day prepared to discuss it. I had no idea we were going to read Catcher in the Rye one word at a time all year. It's not even a very big novel. So I started what the Americans call playing hooky, and I was good at it. I was really good at it. I worked out a series of hall passes, which meant at no point did I need to be anywhere. I used to take the train on a Wednesday, particularly by myself, up into the city in New York, and go to the theater matinee. And I would say to somebody on the door, "Oh, my parents are already in," and sneak in and go and watch theatre. And anyway, my parents then, this is weird, they had never done this ever, they attended a Parents Teachers Association meeting and couldn't find a teacher who knew me. So they decided to send me to British boarding school.
Is that purgatory?
It was the most horrible 4 years of my life.
Was it really?
Mm. I do not understand why the British like to have children and then lock them up.
British cousins, and they look at the child as if it's committed a crime for being a child.
I just find it the weirdest thing. My children are my greatest creation, and any time in their company is better time. Any room they're in is a better room, so I don't understand it.
Now, I find nowadays, and it's clearly something to do with getting older, when I see someone behaving badly or rudely, you know, I do what I once used to laugh at old ladies for doing. I feel like getting an umbrella out and whacking them over the head.
Listen, I have done this. So I was on a train late at night. And there were some young men talking. I don't want to repeat what they said, but they were being extremely disparaging about the young women with whom they had spent the evening. And they were being really vulgar and using really vulgar language, okay? These were, and they'd been drinking, so there's six or seven lads like this, and I'm the only other person in the train carriage. And I got up and I said, "That will do." And they said, "Sorry."
So I think all of us here need to bear that in mind as we go about our business. Now, in your book, we talk a lot about bad manners, but there's another aspect of manners which we must celebrate, which is beautiful manners.
Yeah.
And I think every now and then, one of the great enlarging things about manners is when you sense, as you talked about at a dinner party, where someone graciously looks after the outsider and brings them into the conversation, those really delicate moments, in a way, when somebody shows beautiful manners to another person. And I think you've got some lovely examples, in fact, in your book.
Well, my favourite probably is to do with the Danish royal family, with which Australia now has a wonderful and strong
connection. We're practically all Danes now.
I met the Crown Princess, and she was delightful. So thank you, Australia, for this extremely nice contribution to the royal family. I had a friend of mine called Patrick Litchfield, who was a wonderful photographer, is no longer with us, sadly, but he was also Lord Litchfield. Now, the fact that he was a lord did not mean he had any money. And when he was a young man, he was in Copenhagen, he was invited to dinner with the King of Denmark, and he had no choice but to go, and in fact he wanted to go, but he didn't have the money to dress quite correctly. So in those days, you gentlemen wore, for the evening, they would have a shirt on, and then on top of the shirt, they would have a stiff front, shirt front, and collar and cuffs. And Patrick did not have the money for the shirt, he simply had the stiff collar, stiff front. But he thought, it's fine, going to dinner with the king, there's no way I'll be taking my jacket off, it's absolutely fine. Anyway, it was an unseasonably warm evening. And after dinner, the ladies retired to the other room, and the gentlemen sitting with port and cigars, and the king said, gentlemen may remove their jackets. And Patrick thought, oh, what am I going to do? This is going to be so awkward. Anyway, he had no choice because it's the king's command, so he took his jacket off, and the king looked at him and went, splendid idea, shirts as well. Said it was the finest example of good manners he had ever come across, because in that moment, not only was he made to feel entirely comfortable, he was made to feel rather clever. So it's a lovely example. And I know this from your book. There's a lovely bit in your book, which if you're going to buy one of the two manners books, buy this one, is much better. there's a lovely bit where you have a man who rants about manners, and he says, oh, it's just a middle-class thing, and it's oppressive, and so on. It isn't at all. What it should be, it's the behaviour that makes the maximum number of people feel comfortable in a given situation. That's it. Be nice, be considerate, be thoughtful. Yes. Treat the other person as you would hope to be treated yourself.
Yes.
There's no harm in it. And people talk nowadays, oh, is it politically correct for a man to open a door for a woman? Help yourself, how nice. And if the gentleman is, if I get there first, maybe I'll open the door. Let's all just be polite to each other. I was on a tube train very recently, and a young man stood up and offered me his seat. Now, I could have said, how dare you, I'm perfectly capable of standing. And I said, that's so kind. And of course he should stand up. I'm 56 years old. He was about 12. Honestly, I've been standing way longer than he has. I just thought it was nice. I thought it was kind. You know, let's all be kind to each other.
And cheers to that. Sandy Toksvig is a writer and broadcaster. She was in Australia in May for the Sydney Writers' Festival. Her book is called Mind Your P's and Q's, The Minefield of Modern Manners. Tomorrow on Best of the Festivals, a wonderful conversation with Indian author Amitav Ghosh, interviewed by RN's Michael Cathcart at this year's Ubud Writers' Festival in Bali. I'm Cassie McCullough. Have a great evening.